Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
Robert, we're starting a new season here on the Florida History Podcast. Thank you to everybody for sticking with us through the Fort series and some of our guests, Dr. Kevin Kokomor of Coastal Carolina University and Dr. Angela Zombeck of UNC Wilmington. It's interesting that these two experts on Florida history both teach at schools in the Carolinas, which might say something about higher education in Florida right now, Robert. But you're back. We're happy to have you back. And I want to thank again Dr. Kokomor and Dr. Zombeck for joining us, kind of sitting in for you on several episodes. So we're going to start a new season about the amusement parks in Florida, the big amusement parks. And it's going to be largely Disney focused, and I'll concede right off the top, I'm kind of an expert on Disney and on Disney Studios, Disney Animation, and the Disney parks, but I know virtually nothing about Universal, SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, have never been to any of them. Well, I was at SeaWorld once on a school trip, never been to Universal, never been to Busch Gardens. So, Robert, you're going to be carrying us in those episodes, and you too have an expertise on Disney. In fact, you've done some writings and have been working on some potential long-term projects related to Disney and to animation. So I think this is right in our wheelhouse and something the listeners will enjoy. Before we start, I want to say we are not going to shy away from the controversies involved in the building of Disney World in Central Florida and the net effects on greater Orlando in terms of water quality, in terms of traffic, in terms of pollution, in terms of sprawl. So we are going to discuss those topics. This isn't going to be a one-sided discussion. We are not going to talk about contemporary politics as we record this in 2024 because we are not, we don't want to talk about Ron DeSantis and Disney, that controversy, but we are going to talk about some of the controversial aspects of Disney's legacy in Central Florida, specifically on the community. So, Robert, let's start in the late 1950s. Disneyland, after kind of a disastrous opening day in Anaheim, and then a shaky first year, 1956, it begins to take off. Disney Studios are churning hit after hit. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea comes out in that period with Kirk Douglas starring. So you have Disney continuing to be the leading animation studio along with Warner Brothers at the time. Disney continuing to create more good children's content, and Walt Disney having an amusement park unlike any other in the world in Anaheim. And he begins looking at where he's going to build a second amusement park. And the first thought is Palm Beach County, Florida, where the MacArthur family owned tons of land. And those of you who live in South Florida now probably know the MacArthur State Park in northern Palm Beach County, right on the water. Beautiful area that was donated to the state by the family. And then also the J.N. MacArthur Interchange at Sunrise Boulevard and the Florida Turnpike in Broward County. That was MacArthur family land that was given to the state or to the Turnpike Authority to build the turnpike through Broward County at that point. They were giants in South Florida. They owned tons of land, the MacArthur Dairy, I'm sure most people have heard of. But that didn't work out for Walt and for the prospective amusement park.
So Walt Disney was a very ambitious man. By the 1950s, he was bored of animation. Pretty much sick and tired of it. Animation was something that was used for him to accelerate his career and do a number of different artistic projects. And by the 1950s, he pretty much did everything with the medium that he had wanted to do. So he was looking at new avenues, one of which was undoubtedly television and Disneyland, as we mentioned just a moment ago. And that kind of turned his attention not from diesel and easel canvas and paper, but to bricks and mortar. He decided that he wanted to essentially go into the engineering and the construction business. all throughout the last decade of his life, he basically went from one construction idea or thesis to another throughout every single corner of the United States. He was gratified by Disneyland, we will say, but he was not blind to its limitations, one of which was undoubtedly size. It is always shocking for somebody the first time they go to Disneyland, especially if they had gone to Disney World and they have a memory of Disney World, because you enter Disneyland and it is absolutely, positively a cramped experience.
Let me give you a great Florida comparison, which is if you go to the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine, the most majestic of forts in the country, really, colonial forts. And then you go to Fort Matanzas, about 15 miles south, expecting something similar because you look at pictures and, you know, some of the architectural and design features are the same. And it's also built of coquina rock. You go to Fort Matanzas and it could fit in one corner of the Castillo. These are the two great forts in St. Augustine. That is really kind of the Disney World versus Disneyland comparison. Yeah. It's very similar.
Another comparison that people, especially in Disney, the Disney parks themselves, they like to compare, is that the entirety of Disneyland can fit in the parking lot of Disney World.
Yeah.
So you're talking about 500 acres of land, which stretched the Disney pocketbook to its limits in the 1950s. And you compare that to the size that they ended up dealing with in the Orlando area, which I believe is somewhere of the neighborhood of about 30,000 acres. Most of it is still undeveloped, but it's a huge volume of land compared to what they were dealing with. And one of the greatest frustrations for Walt was the fact that because it was cramped, they also didn't own the surrounding area. So you have Disneyland exploding on the West Coast. Attendance is going through the roof. People are loving it. And all of these different mom and pop businesses are popping up just outside of the gates. And, you know, the best way to compare it is if you go down to downtown Orlando today, you'll see a few, you know, half-day amusement parks or water parks that are by the strip or right off the strip. They're about 15 to 10 miles away from Disney World in Orlando's Universal Orlando Resort. They're an eyesore if you're on the main strip, but they're not really an annoyance for Disney. And there's all of those little t-shirt huts and park ticket places and all that stuff. Imagine every single one of those right outside of Disneyland. And that's what you had. And it drove Walt insane.
Imagine all of 192 being right at the gates.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, and they didn't have a lot of parking, and it was they didn't have an official hotel right away. And it was frustrating. But one thing Walt did notice was that he was able to get a lot of sponsorships for every single one of his rides. And that gave him an idea moving forward that a good way to build is to spend other people's money. And so for the next 10 years of his life, that would essentially be his go-to default mode for funding his projects. Remember that, because it will come up later, especially when we talk about the World's Fair.
Yeah.
But Walt started sending scouts throughout the country looking for places. There were ideas at first about maybe doing it in the Dakotas. There were ideas about maybe doing it in the Midwest. There's a lot of amusement parks in the Midwest, surprisingly, but there are. And finally, they looked down in the South and they said, you know, there's a market there. And then they looked at Florida, which most of South Florida at the time was very pastoral. There was a lot of cattle. There was a lot of private land. And it was very affordable. And as my dear friend just mentioned a few minutes ago, they were owned by a lot of very rich people that were getting older and were wondering what they could do with that land. And they were more than willing to part with it. And that was when he started pitching the concept of Disney sweeping in and buying the properties. One of the reasons why it fell by the wayside and why he started moving more north towards Central Florida is because those in South Florida knew what they had. They knew that people were coming in by the bushel to South Florida. Developers were already there. They were already beginning to build high-rises. You saw the beginning stages of places like North Miami Beach taking place. A lot of people were coming from the north. It wasn't going to be pastoral for long. So they were totally fine with Disney buying up their interests in land, but he had to pay for it. And he didn't have the money to give them what they were asking for. So he sent agents up north, and they found a place in Central Florida, and they realized, well, we could probably get pretty much as much land as you need, but you need to do something. You need to start making shell companies, because the moment people know that it's Disney buying property, the prices are going to go skyrocket. And that was, he realized, and Roy in particular, his brother, who was the financial genius behind the both of them, he also realized that was pretty much the main reason why South Florida fell through, is because as soon as they saw Walt Disney, they thought, oh, California, Hollywood, big money. And the reality is that Disney at this time was essentially the world's most successful independent filmmaker. He was very much in the guise of a George Lucas, profitable, made good money, making his movies, was very successful, but didn't really like the idea of having studio interference, wasn't actually in the studio system, and usually only dealt with studios when he needed to distribute his films. That's one of the reasons why you'll notice, especially in a lot of the earlier movies, you'll see RKO come up. RKO was a smaller distributor, but they were enough of Hollywood to kind of deal with and make sure that people actually got the money of the movie, but they were also okay to let him basically do whatever he wanted.
Which, by the way, Orson Welles took advantage of in the making of Citizen K. It was RKO that that allowed him to do that. No other major studio would, or no other a facilitator would have allowed him to do that. But continue.
He almost killed RKO.
Yeah, well, that's true. Right. Yeah, William Randolph Hearst was convinced that they needed to be put out of business. By the way, Hearst is probably a topic we should cover on a future podcast because there are a lot of Florida ties to Hearst. But Absolutely. Yeah, continue.
So anyway, they start making a bunch of different shell companies. Which is might sound a little bit seedy to people in this day and age, but it is a surprisingly common occurrence in the business world, especially back then. And I believe it totaled somewhere around 75 shell companies, and they were just slowly buying up land every day, every year. They were buying up parcel here, parcel there, and before long, newspapers started noticing that, you know, there were these land companies that nobody had ever heard of buying up land side by side to one another. And one of the great things about Florida is we have very dogged and determined journalists. We always have. Not too much nowadays because the newspaper industry is falling by the wayside, but back then we had great journalists. And so eventually they uncovered who it was. And right around the same time, the Florida legislature was starting to get wind. that the governor's office had begun communication with Disney, which they thought was kind of odd. And then the Florida legislature put two and two together, and they realized, oh, good Lord, Disney has about 15% of Orlando out of nowhere. And it just sort of spiraled after that.
Yeah, and that was the acquisition of the land, and we're going to get into the Florida project and all of that in the next episode. Before we wrap up this episode, I want to mention a few things and then get your take on it. One, Walt also began to look at developing live documentaries about nature and animals. So that's kind of your precursor to Animal Kingdom being built years and years and years after his death in actually the early 2000s, right? We're talking 40 years later from the period we're talking about. Second, you mentioned the Midwest. So Walt got very far along in building a in potentially building a colonial American land in downtown St. Louis, right in the city, in what was the gateway to the West. And that was something that he spent a lot of time and energy on planning. And as you said, there were amusement parks in the Midwest. It was not uncommon to have amusement parks there. And that was, in that particular case, St. Louis, not far from where Walt grew up. But it fell through, and a lot of those concepts were then applied, as we will talk about in a future episode, to Liberty Square, and even a little bit to Frontierland in the Magic Kingdom. The third thing, and I want you to chime in on this, Robert, because I think this is such an important event in the evolution of Walt Disney World in Florida, the New York World's Fair. Which was being run by Robert Moses, very controversial figure. Anyone who's read Robert Caro's master biography of Robert Moses is probably predisposed not to like Moses. Moses was already getting a lot of flack by that time. His reputation was permanently damaged when Caro's biography came out in 74. We're talking now 1964. He's thinking the World's Fair may be his redemption at Flushing Park. Walt Disney ended up playing a very big role in that, Robert. And in fact, three of the attractions that we have in the Magic Kingdom and that have been long-term attractions in the Magic Kingdom came directly out of that World's Fair.
So the New York World's Fair in 1964 was the last triumph of Walt Disney's life and career, without exception. He was interested in doing an exhibit for the World's Fair because he wanted to get a potential future sponsor for a new East Coast Walt Disney Park. He already knew all of the sponsors for the World's Fair. They were already sponsors of Disneyland exhibits, especially in Tomorrowland. He was very close with them because one of the major issues with Tomorrowland is the fact that as soon as it's done, you might as well call it Retroland. It always has to be redone. And so he was very good friends with them because he needed them badly. And at the same time, as I had alluded to, he sort of stepped away from animation and he started getting immersed in live action. And one of the things with live action, because his movies had budgetary constrictions, is he started developing and nurturing and hiring some really great special effects artists, some really great practical effects artists, and some production designers. So he was really becoming not just an animator, but a great visual storyteller in the actual 3D world, because he was able to do things like, you know, scale, force perspective, miniature design, all of these different things that are totally divorced from the world of animation. And so that kind of set him up for the creation of what is now, I think, probably universally the most important, especially in the theme park industry, the most important aspect of Disney, and that is the Imagineers, the people that actually built the attractions, that designed them, storyboarded them, created them. And that was really how they got involved. And so what you saw with the New York World's Fair was you saw this marriage of industrial engineering, because all of these different sponsors that he hooked up with, they, you know, were making airplane parts, they were making car parts, they knew how to work with metal, they knew how to make electronics. And the marriage between them and his Imagineers, who knew how to make beautiful, gorgeous concepts look believable and presentable and enthralling in the real world. So he worked very, very hard, him and his people, for about a year to make not only a fully formed, still used animatronic of Abraham Lincoln, which that attraction still is over in Disneyland, but it would be the precursor to the even more ambitious Hall of Presidents in Disney World. But he also created what was probably, in his mind, his magnum opus to everything Americana, and that was the Carousel of Progress. And he also, with Pepsi Cola, which he could really thank his friendship with Joan Crawford. And any of you who are fans of this ride, before you start believing the gossip behind Mommy Dearest, just remember that it was Joan Crawford that convinced Pepsi Cola to sponsor It's a Small World.
She was on the Pepsi board, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. So before you grab a wire hanger and start mocking her, if you like It's a Small World, you owe her something. So with those three attractions, he pretty much dominated the World's Fair. He got all of the attention. He basically did it for pennies. I mean, they had to pay his people. But the catalyst was that he said, okay, well, I'll make these attractions for you, but when the World's Fair is done in a year or so, I want them. And they were like, yeah, sure, go ahead. You know, we can't put them in the lobby. You can have them. And so essentially he got three amusement park attractions for free. And it was because of his involvement in the World's Fair. And whether it is the Hall of Presidents, whether it is the Carousel of Progress, or It's a Small World, I don't think you could have the Disney experience of the 1970s and 80s without one of those. And it all was due to his involvement in the World's Fair. And in large part, those attractions are one of the reasons why it is still today regarded as the World's Fair that most people remember.
Join us next week as we will talk about the build-up, Walt's death, and the build-up to the opening of Walt Disney World in Central Florida in 1971.